Welcome to New Books and Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. In this episode, I talk with William J. Bush about his book, Greenback Dollar, The Incredible Rise of the Kingston Trio, published in 2013 by the Scarecrow Press. Two young men from Hawaii, one from Southern California. They meet in the San Francisco Bay Area. A shared love of Hawaiian, Tahitian, country, and folk music, not to mention drinking and carousing, brings them together to play frat parties in college bars in the area. They played the Cracked Pot on the 101 and the Purple Onion in North Beach. They recorded a version of murder ballad Tom Dooley, which became a huge hit, not only across genre charts in the U.S., but across the world. And the Kingston Trio, from 1958 through 1961, were one of the most popular bands in the world. They were very much the catalyst for the revival of folk music in the late 50s and early 60s. The success of artists such as Simon and Garfunkel, the Mamas and the Papas, and yes, even Bob Dylan owe much to the trio as their predecessors. In Greenback Dollar, Bill Bush chronicles the full career of the Kingston Trio, starting with the Dave Guard Trio, through the John Stewart Trio, and even to an extent to modern versions of the band that contain no original members, but do continue the spirit. His story contains the important characters, Frank Werber, Voyle Gilmore, David Buckwheat, places, Hawaii, Salt Lake City, Notre Dame, and events, a plane crash, the recording of specific albums, that shaped the career of this band. Indeed, changed the direction of popular music in the mid-20th century. William J. Bush lives in Seminole, Florida, which is where I reached him for this interview. Hello, Bill, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Thank you very much, Matt. Good to be here.
No, thanks for being on our show. Let's start, please, first with a little bit of your biography. Tell us, you know, where you're from, et cetera.
Well, I was born in Florida, but I spent most of my career. I went to high school in New Orleans, and I went to college in Austin, Texas for my freshman and sophomore year at St. Edward's University, and then I went to the University of Illinois, and I got my undergraduate and master's degree from Illinois. Mm-hmm. And have worked various places around the country, worked for big agencies in Boston, including Arnold and Company, and worked for Young and Rubicam in St. Petersburg and different areas like that, which is another big agency, and Ozell, where I was creative director in Tampa. And I've been a music journalist most of my career. In addition to that, as you can tell from the places that I've worked, I've also been an advertising copywriter and creative director with major agencies, as well as my own agency, Bush & Co. Advertising. And at the same time, I've been a music journalist, working primarily music magazines, Guitar Player magazine, as well as Acoustic Guitar and various other publications. I've also done a lot of work for the Martin Guitar Company. I've done a lot of work on their Sounding Board, which is their company magazine, and different things like that. But also done a lot of work on the Kingston Trio, which is also another one of my all-time favorite groups, which included writing for Bear Family, for the Kingston Trio two box sets, Capitol Records for their some of their major compilations, and various different things like that. So I've sort of been called upon whenever they needed somebody that knew the Kingston Trio very well. And I finally have completed my book after many years' research on the Kingston Trio. I think it is the first in-depth biography of the group, which was published in December of last year by Scarecrow Press.
That's interesting that, I mean, there's such an influential group to have all the way in 2013, the first biography history of the band.
Well, it really is. I'm not quite sure why that is, because they were such a major influence.
Right.
On popular music and certainly in folk music in the reemergence of folk. Mm-hmm. And the whole folk revival, they were the ones that really set it off in 1958 with the release of Tom Dooley.
So
You also, Bill, had some personal relationships with the members of the Kingston Trio, correct?
Well, they've all been close friends of mine over the years. As a music journalist, that's how I met them originally. Bobby Chain, of course. Nick Reynolds was one of my closest friends for many years. John Stewart. I met them all through writing for Fresh Magazine and different publications like that. I just became real good friends with them. It was just simpatico, if you will.
So and, how much? Please go ahead.
And I got to know them. I guess the bottom line is, I got to know them based on first of all interviewing them for various publications. Okay, that they were in. I think probably the first big article on the Kingston Trio. It was a two-part issue for Fresh Magazine, which used to be I don't believe it's still around anymore, but it was the sister publication to Guitar Player, with their acoustic publication. And so that's how I first met them. That's way back in 83 or so like that. I'd actually met them in Daytona, really, back in 1967 when I saw them when they appeared in concert down here in Daytona. And that's the first time I met them, but it wasn't until years later that I got to know them personally. And been great friends over the years.
So as a writer, as someone who's, I don't know how interested you were in writing something objective or not, but how does these friendships that you had with them, how did that play into your writing of the book?
Well, first of all, what it allowed me was access. And I'm a music journalist, and, I'm neither an apologist for the Kingston Trio, despite the fact that I think they were unquestionably one of the most influential groups in popular music. All of that notwithstanding, my obligation as a music journalist is to be objective. And it's to be objective both in a positive sense and in issues that might be controversial. Thing about the Kingston Trio, there wasn't really a lot of controversy around. Probably the most contentious part of the Kingston Trio's experience was with the folk revival. A lot of people that had never been exposed to traditional music were exposed first through the Kingston Trio, and they really liked it. And then when they got immersed in traditional music and ethnic music and everything, well, they sort of viewed the Kingston Trio as these fraudulent interlopers, that was taking their sacred idiom and making it commercial. So that's where the controversy, if there's ever been any, and I certainly never not address that issue square on in anything that I've written. And the fact that I can be even-handed in writing about them is really, I would think, a prerequisite for anybody that's writing about music. You can personally like their music, and that doesn't mean that you turn a blind side to what the other side of the arguments are, which I've always prided myself on being very even-handed. So in answer to your question, it hasn't affected my objectivity one iota. It has enhanced my access to the group, and I think to the quality of information that I've gotten, because they've been friends and they've always trusted me and to tell it like it was, and that's all they've ever asked. They've never asked me to color or to do anything to their story. They've always been totally upfront. So that's as best as I can answer that, I think.
Yeah. So let's get right to the book, and we'll kind of follow it along along the order and the chapters that you write. So let's okay. begin at the beginning. Tell us about the biographies a little bit of Nick Reynolds and then Bob Chain and Dave Gard, please.
Well, Nick Reynolds was from Coronado, California. dad was a Navy captain. He was born in San Diego, just across the bay there, but he grew up and was raised in Coronado, California. His exposure to music was, there was a lot of island music in and out of Coronado. It's a Navy base, a major Navy base. So he would hear a lot of, he would hear a lot of music from the islands, Hawaiian music. And Tahitian, he was into all kinds of music that he heard there. He was also, at the same time, growing up, you know, was influenced and listened to popular music at the time of the 40s and 50s. And, his dad, being a captain, would bring home a lot of tunes from around the world. His family were very musically oriented, not professionally. But his dad always had Martin ukuleles, and he and Nick and his two sisters learned how to play ukulele as kids, and were taught songs and by their father, Captain Reynolds. So that was a good exposure for him, and they had a lot of family sing-alongs. He learned a lot. He picked up a lot from his sisters, who he said are really the great singers in their in his family. And they had amazing harmony. That's where he learned harmony. And he one time told me, he says, if you really want to know about the great voices in my family, he says, you need to listen to my sisters. And he said, Barbara and Jane, he said they were, they just had wonderful voices and wonderful harmony, which was taught to them by their father, Captain, his name was Stuart, Captain Stuart Reynolds. And so he grew up there, and you know, as he got older, he spent a lot of time, you know, in border towns, Tijuana, different places, which is close to, you know, and the Mexican border is close to Coronado, San Diego area. So he picked up a lot of big influences, you know, mariachi music, and which he heard. And just all kinds of stuff. It was just a great mixing pot, if you were. There were all kinds of, you heard everything from bawdy songs to, you know, traditional Mexican music to all kinds of different things. So that's where he grew, that's where he grew up, in Coronado. And later, when he went away to college, he went to Menlo, which Menlo School of Business, which was not far from Stanford. And in lots of ways, Menlo School of Business Administration was viewed as a kind of a prep school for getting into Stanford. But that's where Nick went, and that's where he graduated, and that's where he met Bobby Shane, too. So that was Nick Reynolds' story, and I'm not even – it would take hours to go through all those interesting things about his career and background. But that's a fair overview.
And now Bobby Shane and Donald Dave Gard, please.
Well, Bobby grew up, first of all, Bobby grew up in Hawaii, as did Dave Gard. They were both born there. Bobby Shane was born in Hilo, Hawaii, and his father was in the sporting goods, was an importer of sporting goods and sports equipment and stuff like that. And the family moved from Hilo to Honolulu, which is where he met Dave Gard. So he met Dave Gard at Hunahou School there in Honolulu, and they became great friends. And at the time, Bobby, like everybody at that time, played ukulele, and he taught Dave Gard that and taught him its first chords on tenor guitar, which essentially was how the ukulele, e-tuned his ukulele to the first four strings of the guitar. Bobby did, taught Dave. And so that's how the two of them got together as students, I think, at Punahou School. And they became interested in, spent a lot of time on the beach, and they particularly liked Tahitian music because all the Hawaiians there pretty much covered the Hawaiian music, but the Tahitian music, which they felt was much more interesting and wilder rhythms and everything out, and that was their thing. And they also, you know, learned lots of body tunes, sailor tunes, and different things like that. And that music in Honolulu. Bobby Shane's mother, I believe, is from Utah, in Salt Lake City. And his father, I believe, was born in Honolulu, or was born in the islands in Hilo. And Bobby was born there. So they were not Hawaiians. They were Honoluluans, I guess you would call it. You know? And they were Americans, okay? You know, all of their families had their roots primarily in the States. They were also, I believe, Bob was related to some of the missionaries that came to the islands. And there were relationships there with people that originally come from Boston, actually missionaries that had come from Boston. But essentially, you know, Dave and Bobby always viewed the United States as the motherland, if you will. So that's what I've got on that.
So it seems important to the story, or we'll see if you think it's important, that, you know, whenever we read stories of popular music in rock or folk, race and class kind of play into it. These three guys, Nick, Bob, and Dave, all come from relatively privileged positions in our society. And I think that, you know, their popularity on the college circuit comes from that. What do you think?
I think first of all, okay, that they were certainly less that they were privileged. I think, but that their background musically, I think, fit in. I mean, you know, Dave Gard went to Stanford. Graduated from Stanford and went to Stanford Business School, in fact. Okay, so it's a function of his education, that's for sure. Very, very brilliant man. Bobby Shane ultimately graduated from Menlo School of Business Administration. He didn't get his degree until years later. And I think he dropped out in his senior year, or he did not have enough credits to graduate, but years later, he did get his degree. Nick, of course, came from a privileged family. He went to school at University of Arizona and flunked out. Also went to San Diego State, and he eventually wound up at Menlo, which is in Menlo Park, which is not far from Stanford, Palo Alto. And Bobby said to him, he said, "You got to meet this friend of mine, Dave Gard, who was at Stanford." So that's how those three got together. Nick and Bobby were pals, and Dave and Bobby knew each other from Honolulu, were friends, and they all got together. And then when Bobby left Menlo, Nick and Dave became very close friends and started playing in a group, Dave Garden, the Calypsonians. And so it all coalesced, you know, in that area, and then moved on to San Francisco, where they got gigs at the Purple Onion in particular, and later at the Hungry Eye, and different places around.
Mm-hmm. So give us a little more detail of that, then, of When does the Kingston Trio first exist with that name, and how does it come to be?
It came to be when they met a publicist by the name of Frank Werber. And Frank Werber was a publicist for The Hungry Eye, as well as The Purple Onion. And he had gotten a tip from a waiter about this group that were playing down at a college beer joint type place called The Crack Pot, which is near Stanford. And so I guess he went down and he saw them one night. But, you know, there's been a lot of folklore about how somehow he was so mesmerized with the group that he had to sign a contract on a napkin, which is not true. It's just baloney. But it did introduce them to him. And with Dave Gard, who had gotten a gig up in San Francisco, play in a place, it wasn't the Purple Onion, but it was a place up in California, or up in San Francisco, excuse me, that they got a gig, and I think it might have been the Spaghetti Factory or one of those places, and that really set the stage for it. And they decided, Nick and Dave had invited Frank Werber to come up and see them, Dave Gard and the Calypsonian, Israel. Bobby was in Honolulu having been asked to leave Menlo because he didn't have enough credits or whatever it was. His grades weren't where they needed to be. And he invited Nick and Dave invited Frank Werber to come up and to see them. When Bobby Shane left Menlo, I'm not sure that he flunked out, although that's the story, but he didn't have enough credits to graduate. I know that. And he went back to Honolulu to work in his father's athletic supply company, which really didn't last long, and that's when he started playing professionally as a solo artist, singer in different taverns and things in Honolulu. Meanwhile, stateside, Dave Gard and Nick started playing under the Dave Gard and the Calypsonians, and they would get gigs around that area, and they got one up in San Francisco at the Italian Village, which was kind of a restaurant with a lounge thing. I think it was in the basement or whatever. And so they had invited Frank Werber, who had come down to see them one time down at the Cracked Pot, which was in near Stanford in Palo Alto. Or Menlo Park, one or the other, was halfway between them. And that's when Werber really got interested in them. And Werber said, you know, it was easier, it was difficult to get bookings for a group that had four people in it. And he told them that it would be easier for him to get some bookings if they were a trio. And, you know, Bob Shane was over in Honolulu, and Nick wrote him a couple of letters, said, you need to get back over here because we have a gig at the Italian Village. And so Bobby came back over, and he and Dave and Nick got together. And one of the first things they had to Werber sat him down and said, okay, what are you going to call yourself? And it's been said that Dave Gard and Calypsonians had all also worked under the working title of the Kingston Quartet. That they just shortened it to the Kingston Trio. Dave Gard and the Calypsonians were the Kingston Quartet or whatever they wanted to call themselves at the time. Any name would do, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's how the trio emerged. And they thought it was the perfect name, okay, because it had both an island feel, you know, like a Jamaican feel of Kingston, Jamaican, and also had kind of an Ivy League sound, like, you know, the Kingston Trio. With Ivy League-ish sounding. So that's how they got their name. Mm-hmm. And it stuck. Mm-hmm. And that's where the name came about, and they were the Kingston Trio. And they're still the Kingston Trio to this day. So.
At one point, you write that Bobby Shane was the foundation of the Kingston Trio. What do you mean by that?
Well, the foundation of the Kingston Trio, sound-wise, is Bobby Shane. Bobby Shane's voice is probably the most distinctive voice in the group, and he had a great voice, great unique voice, baritone voice. He was a great rhythm guitarist. I don't think he played more than three or four chords, but boy, did he play them. He had a lot of power coming off that Martin B-28, and he was the lead voice. He was a lead voice throughout the Kingston Trio. I mean, they would all take solo verses and, you know, sometimes would sing solo songs on their albums. But primarily, the Kingston Trio was based on Bobby Shane's voice. Mm-hmm. Nick, who is a fine singer, has a great singing voice, was a master of harmonization, which he learned from his sisters and his father. And he could sing anything. He could harmonize with anything. And Bobby told me, he said, you know what? He said, Nick was the only singer that I, or person that I immediately liked personally from the get-go, and he was the only person that I knew that could instantly pick a harmony out. He didn't have to go over it 10 times. He said he knew instinctively where to sing. Mm-hmm. So you put those two together, and that's the Kingston Trio. That defines the Kingston Trio sound. Now, Dave Gard, who also had a fine singing voice, his forte was that he got the joker parts. Those were the parts that filled in either above or below or in between or whatever of what Reynolds and Shane were singing. That was the total capitalization of the sound.
Mm-hmm.
What he called the joker parts.
And Dave,
that was later, okay, because it was the least, it wasn't as prominent as the harmony, and it wasn't as prominent as the lead voice, but it was all important because it filled in everywhere. If you're just talking vocally,
mm-hmm.
It was also the most transparent. Where you listen to a Kingston Trio tune, you can hear Bobby and you can hear Nick, and sometimes you can hear Dave. Okay, but he's filling in either below or above or around or whatever that he did. So that was what, but the sound was based on Bobby Shane, the basic
mm-hmm.
voice in the group. The lead voice in the group was Bob Shane.
So let's skip forward a little bit, and how do they go about getting their first record and their first label?
Their first record, there was a producer at Capitol Records. When they got with Frank Werber, he was sending out demo tapes of the group, of the Kingston Trio, to different record labels, to like Dot Records, and sent one to Capitol, and might have even sent one to Decca or different places. But I know that he sent one to Capitol. But there was a producer, top producer at Capitol by the name of Boyle Gilmore, who had been with Capitol for a number of years, but he became at one point the head of A&R at Capitol, but he was primarily a producer. He was one of their top producers. And he had heard about them when they were singing at Purple Onion, and he really liked a lot. But he had first sent somebody else up there, a guy named Lee, I think it was Lee Gillette was the guy's name, I'm not absolutely certain. And he wanted to have him check them out. And Lee came back and wasn't impressed at all. And in fact, Boyle Gilmore had said one time he wasn't sure that Lee actually had ever heard them. But he went up himself to get a listen to them at the Purple Onion, and he was knocked out. He thought they were terrific. And he was the one, they got the deal at Capitol Records, a contract for one album, I believe it was, to begin with. Dot wanted to sign them to a singles only, and Werber didn't want to do that. So that's how they got their first album with Capitol, T996.
That's how the aficionados refer to them, right?
I think so. Yeah.
you mentioned at one point there's an important moment or time in their career that is based in Salt Lake City. Can you tell that story, please?
Well, I'll tell you how that started. That album, you know, let me say this, that from the outset, Capitol Records wasn't sure that they had any big deal in the Kingston Trio. Okay? Royal Gilmore liked them a lot. But it could have been just a one album deal. And that album was sent out to a lot of radio stations, one of which was in Salt Lake City. And and that's really, there were a couple of disc jockeys in Salt Lake City who heard the album, and they liked the Kingston Trio, and they liked very much. They found the song Tom Dooley on there that they particularly liked. And that really, really made, all of a sudden, Salt Lake City was in love with the Kingston Trio. And that happens in different markets like that. You know, different groups always, you know, either break out in one place or another. And sometimes it's just in an obscure place. Salt Lake City, while it's not a small city, it's not a really big one either. And that's really where their popularity started. They were like, they had at one time three or four of their albums later on, you know, were in the top 10 in Salt Lake City. And that's where they really, really got their popularity started. And then from there, in Salt Lake City. And then these disc jockeys at this radio station would call their friends, you know, and tell them about this great group, the Kingston Trio. Next thing you know, Miami's playing that album. And they're playing Tom Dooley, and then, you know, in different cities around the country. And so that's how it really got started.
And the importance, tell us about Tom Dooley. I mean, that was the breakout, right? I mean, not just for the...
Well, the disc jockey's name in Salt Lake City was Paul Coburn, okay? Was the disc jockey who took a liking to that tune, okay? And he had another guy that worked with him there called Bill Terry. Those were the two disc jockeys at the same station in Salt Lake City that really, really got it started. And it was a top station in Salt Lake City. And these guys had friends, they're disc jockey friends around the country. And that's really how it got started. That's how the buzz started. And they loved Tom Dooley, but, you know, they had the album, they played everything on it. But Tom Dooley was the one that broke out. It broke out in Salt Lake City. And Paul Coburn would tell his friends all over the country in different stations. And that's how it broke out.
And Tom Dooley, though, it becomes a number one song across the country, right? And even around, you know, the world in Europe, right?
Well, yes, it did. Tom Dooley is based on a true story of a Confederate soldier, Tom Dula, who killed his lover, I think her name was Laura Foster, when he found out that she'd been untrue to him, guess while he was away. And it was a ballad that started back in the 1860s. And it had been passed around, and it had even been, I believe, a popular tune in the late 1920s. And the trio heard it from a guy, I believe his name is Frank Warner, who was a folklorist and collector, who had picked up on that tune. And either he or another gentleman came to auditions, open auditions, at the Purple Onion one day, and that's where they first heard that tune. And the trio kind of rearranged it a little bit to their own liking. But essentially, it's the same. It's an old tune that became popular after, you know, it had been amended to some degree by the Kingston Trio. It was great too in another way, another dimension, and that was, it was easy to play. Basically two chords, and it just caught the public's interest, and it became popular at a particular time in music in the late 1950s, okay? First of all, an alternative to rock and roll, which became wildly famous in the mid-50s, primarily with Elvis Presley, 56, 57, 58, and then, of course, Elvis went into the Army. And Jerry Lee Lewis had bounced off the airwaves, starting in England, I believe, because he had married his third cousin. And it was just an alternative that caught people's ears that they really liked. And as I said in my book, you know, America has always had a warm spot in its heart for the occasional oddball record, you know, like the Chipmunks. Tom Dulles did that, okay? Where did this come from? It came out of nowhere. It wasn't rock. It wasn't pop. It wasn't, you know, how much is that doggy in the window? It was just totally different, and it just grabbed people's imagination. And that was the start of it. People could see, you know, that it was an accessible tune. That's one of the great things about the Kingston Trio. Their music was always accessible. You know, they were memorable tunes, they were easy to sing, and they were easy to play. And that really started started the folk revival, that particular folk revival of the late 50s and early 60s.
So they got
the one of them all. There had been other folk revivals, you know, vis-a-vis the Weavers. Earlier versions of that. There had been a revival in the 40s. There had been one in the early 50s with the Weavers, and the late one, the biggest one, that was the big boom. Okay, it was the late 50s, early 60s folk revival. That's what caught the ear of people like Bobby Dylan and Joan Baez and numerous other singers.
And they got very popular very quickly, right?
It certainly did.
Mm-hmm. Through,
I mean, to this day, they are so closely associated with that.
Mm-hmm. And they did some they toured a lot as well, right? As any band will do that's going to get popular like that.
Well, they did. They became very popular very quickly among college students, and they were really, if you went to college in the late 50s and early 60s, remember, the Kingston Trio was your group. And the Kingston Trio really started the popularity of the college concert. And they worked the college, major college circuit all over the country. And they were enormously popular with college kids. And, you know, their popularity at the same time, you know, they started, people started, you know, playing acoustic music. And the acoustic music, musical instrument industry came alive. I mean, it was one of the greatest. People were playing banjos, and, you know, the Kingston Trio played Martin guitars. That's virtually the only guitars they played, and they were prominently displayed on every album cover that they ever had. A Vega banjo and a Martin guitar. Nick played a Martin tenor. Bobby played a Martin D28. Dave Gard occasionally played a Martin 0028. I've seen him play. And they were always on the cover. And, you know, back then, if you listen to it, it is the wonderful thing about album covers, you know, is that they give you something to look at while you're listening to the music. And people study them, you know, for what is that? Remember one time when I went to high school in New Orleans, I had some Kingston Trio albums, and I couldn't figure out what that label was on the headstock of Martin guitars. I didn't know they were called Martin. I didn't know that they were Martin guitars. And I went to a music store on Canal Street, and I asked them, did they handle the same guitars that the Kingston Trio played? And the guy said, oh, yeah. And I said, are they called National? I couldn't tell what that scroll work was. But he said, no, he said, that scroll says C.F. Martin and Company and Co. And that's, you know, that's how Martin immediately, you know, they were overwhelmed with orders for their guitars. And they were a little company, relatively speaking, an old line company, probably one of the oldest musical instrument manufacturers in the country. They were in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. They were very popular among country western players at that time, but it was essentially a small market. But when the Kingston Trio became popular, the demand on Martin guitars was so big that they were back-ordered 3 years. And they eventually had to move to another, build another factory there in Nazareth. So they could build more Martin guitars that they could manufacture. And that's really what everybody benefited from the Kingston Trio at that juncture. Musical instrument manufacturers, you know, recording companies, concert promoters, you know, even fashion. Fashion took a bump up, you know, with striped shirts and everything, and the Ivy League style and everything. All of it has its genesis in the popularity of the Kingston Trio. That renewal of interest in all of those things that the Kingston Trio did.
Mm-hmm. So we need to jump up quickly because I don't want to leave John Stewart out of our story. So can you tell us of the ousting, the breakup of the original tour trio, the ousting of Dave Gard and subsequently John Stewart coming into the band, please?
Yes. Well, Dave Gard was a key member of the Kingston Trio. And whereas Bobby and Nick defined the sound essentially, Dave Gard really was a brilliant guy and a brilliant arranger. And he was probably the only one in the Kingston Trio at that time that read music. And he arranged a lot of those songs. Those were Dave Gard arrangements. And he'd say, okay, Bobby, you sing lead. Nick, you sing here. I'm going to sing here. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And he was key to making that music what it was. If you listen to the albums of Dave Gard era, they have a distinctive intellectual edge to them. They're very, very intelligent songs. And most of those arrangements came from Dave Gard. Although they all learned to head arrange, but essentially, and as it went along, they had a problem with a publisher who was using some of their music and. But he was retaining some of their royalties to cover his own gambling debts. And they all had their own publishing companies within the group. Dave got his check. The Kingston Trio had one where their royalties were brought through publishing company. And Dave got a check for $15,000 from their publisher, and it bounced. And that started the trouble. And Dave was furious, and he was determined that from now on in, he would have control over the group. He would control what they sang, what they did. Because they had called him in jest, but with a grain of truth, that he was their acknowledged leader. And even though they all worked very, very hard, Dave Gard was a key component, but they were all key components to it. And he didn't like this music publisher. And he was determined that they were going to all be under his control at this point. And he didn't like Frank Werber either. He thought that Frank Werber was somehow in cahoots with this guy, which he wasn't, and that they would get a publisher of his choice, of Dave Gard's choice. So it really got down to push and shove, and he told them that that's what he was going to do. He was going to be the head of the Kingston Trio, and they were going to do exactly what he directed them to do, in effect. And that he was the only one, really, that he implied that he was the one that had all the talent and everything. So they got together, and he said, it's either my way or I'm leaving. And they said, well, bye. And so that was the end of the first Kingston Trio. And it was very low time for them all. Dave Gard was a very, very good man. And despite what happened to them, that over the years, you know, they missed Dave Gard and they fought highly of, and but nonetheless, they had to move on. And when they finally decided that they were going to go for it and they were going to get another person on the Kingston Trio would survive, John Stewart, they knew John Stewart because he was just a young kid. He was a teenager, I think, when he first met them. And he had written some songs. Molly D was one of them. Here we go again, singing a song about Molly D, which, as you know, the title of one of their albums was Here We Go Again. So they knew John as a songwriter. And John was a huge Dave Gard fan and emulated him in lots of ways. He played banjo, and he played it very well. He knew how to sing all of the parts on a Kingston Trio song. He was had studied them very carefully and studied Dave Gard and his influence. So he was a natural to take over. I believe he was only 21 years old when he joined the trio. I believe they were 5 years or 6 years older than he was. But that's how John Stewart came into the picture. And they were able to prevail for another 6 years after that. Most people thought that when Dave Gard left, that would be the end of the Kingston Trio, and they had certainly proved them wrong in that. The John Stewart Trio was a different trio. A trio like the Dave Gard Trio. What they referred to as Dave Gard, the trio with Dave Gard. But John Stewart, while he was a huge fan of Dave Gard's, in my opinion, the second Kingston Trio, which was with John Stewart, did not have the intellectual edge for Byte, perhaps, the same as did Guard. But in my opinion, it was more musical. It was more musical. It was more energetic. It was more young-sounding. And I think that it was certainly an equal in terms of the quality of recordings that they did with the Dave Guard era albums.
In fact, in Chapter 12, where you're going over their recordings, you suggest that they're recording Time to Think, which is with John Stewart. You write that it's their finest hour.
It was a beautiful album. It was a magnificent album. But there were others, too. New Frontier, great album. Number 16, a great album. I mean, if you listen to it. And you know what happened, too, Matt, is that those albums on Capitol at that time, the technology that they learned at Capitol Records and Boyle Gilmore of fattening vocals, of double voicing, the choruses, run through those magnificent big old concrete echo chambers that were underground, under the parking lot at Capitol. It just gave that those recordings such power. There was an engineer named Pete Abbott. His real name was William Abbott, Bill Abbott. But they called him Pete. Pete was a nickname. Pete Abbott, who was their engineer and who also was involved with Boyle Gilmore in the editing and selecting of tracks. Those albums, even to this day, 50 years after the fact, are a marvel to listen to. Time to Think was a very special album in that while they were recording it, they, you know, everybody used to say, well, you've never done anything socially relevant in your songs, you know. It's always been, you know, just lighter fare. And they wanted to do some songs that were more socially conscious, if you will. And while they were recording, or they were in rehearsals, excuse me, while they were in rehearsals for Time to Think, John Kennedy, JFK, was assassinated. And one of the songs on that album, Song for a Friend, is about John Kennedy. Was written the day after John Kennedy's, or second day after John Kennedy's assassination. And there were some beautiful songs, all had serious meaning. That's an important album in their career, and beautiful. But also the other songs, the other albums they had done prior to that with John Stewart were terrific. Starting with Close Up. If you listen to Close Up, which was their first album with John Stewart on Capitol, you can just tell it's a different day altogether. It's a really enthused and rejuvenated Kingston Trio that sings on it, younger sounding because of Stewart and his whole spirit. The next album after that was College Concert, which was recorded at UCLA. Fun, a lot of humor, a lot of interaction with the crowd. It just got better and better and better and better, you know? So
why do they end?
Well, I think they ended Bobby Shane didn't want to end that trio. But John Stewart, it started getting into the era of, the protest era. And John wanted to write those songs, those types of songs, wanted to write protest material, wanted to write those songs. And he was a patriot, and he had gone to Selma, Alabama for the march. He just wanted to do different types of stuff. He was tired of doing the Kingston Trio stuff. He just wanted to do more songs. He wanted to be part of the of that genre of music, of the, of the topical folk singer, the single performer, in fact. And he wanted to be a part of that. He wanted to do that. And at this time, the Kingston Trio had been together for 10 years, and Nick said, I'm kind of tired of doing this, too. And he had bought a ranch up in Oregon, wanted to move to Oregon, which he did. And I've had, conversations with Bobby about that. And he said that he was ready to go, too. He said that, but he was the one that really, I think, really would have preferred for it to continue on, and eventually it did continue on with him. But the times were changing musically out there. And the Kingston Trio was still doing the same thing. They felt they weren't doing relevant music. And when they tried to do relevant music that was more like folk rock or more protest-oriented or just a different sound, they did an album, and I believe it was called something else, which had electric guitars and different electrical instruments, drums. It was a killer album, really, really good album. And why it never caught on, I don't know. I just think it was no longer relevant, maybe by the nature of the material they were doing. It's no longer relevant. America was moving on with different things, but they really, they really nailed it in terms of doing something different, but it wasn't anything that caught on enough for them to continue. So with that, they got together with Frank Werber, and they decided that they were going to disband the Kingston Trio. They were going to go out on the road for a year and do all of their farewell concerts and whatever. And that would be the end of it, and that's what happened. And that's why the Kingston Trio ended, essentially at the urging of John Stewart, who wanted to move on. And Nick said, I think Nick was tired, and he wanted to move to Oregon, which he did. Beautiful ranch on the Elk River in Port Orford. And Bobby started, he played for a while as a duo with Travis Edmondson, and he did some solo things and in different venues. And then he eventually reformed a group. The Kingston Trio. He wanted to reform a Kingston Trio, and the name was owned. The Kingston Trio was owned by Frank Werber, Nick Reynolds, and Bob Shane. So to be able to call it the Kingston Trio, he had to lease the name from the two of them. But the caveat was that he couldn't call it the Kingston Trio. He had to call it the New Kingston Trio to distinguish it from the other group, and that was a requisite. He also gave up all his royalties from the Kingston Trio prior to that time, and he had to forfeit those to them, and so it became the New Kingston Trio, and then eventually Bobby bought the name outright from Nick and Frank. And it became the Kingston Trio again. And to this day, Bob toured with, was one of the Kingston Trio again for a number of years. And then for health reasons, he had to come off the road. And George Grove, who had been with him for many years in those permutations, other people were brought in to take Shane's place. And today, the Kingston Trio is George Grove and Bill Thorne and Rick Doherty. And they're a very, very good, terrific musical group. And I think we're the evolution of the Kingston Trio. In spirit and sound, and but they're a distinct group. They're their own distinct Kingston Trio. So that's how that has evolved.
That's fascinating that they're, it's still a band, right? The band exists above and beyond now, really, the individual members at this point.
I think they are at this juncture. You have to understand, okay, that for some people, okay, there will only be the Shane, Reynolds, and Guard configuration as the real Kingston Trio. There will be some that it will only be the Shane, Reynolds, and Stewart group that were the Kingston Trio. And a middle group who said either one of those two is fine. That's the Kingston Trio. Any group after that isn't the Kingston Trio. And there are some people who say, well, I love the music. And whoever's singing it and singing the Kingston Trio songs, that's the Kingston Trio if they've been given the name. And, you know, Bob Shane owns it. And he was that thread through all of it. And in fact, Nick Reynolds came back into the group in the 1980s and was back out on the road with them for 10 years. And it was Shane, Reynolds, and Grove. You know, so there's a thread all the way through. And but people love that music. And, you know, some people love it only from Guard. Some people love it only from the Stewart Trio. And some people love it however they hear it. You know, there are some people who are huge fans of the present Kingston Trio, who've never heard the earlier group, that only know the Kingston Trio that way, and that's legitimate.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for being on our show. It's been a fascinating interview, and it's a great book.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Matt, thank you so much for having me on, and I hope that our interview will encourage people to certainly buy their music and listen to it and find out what it's all about. And I sure hope they'll buy my book, because that'll help me a lot, too, because then I can write another one. So just kidding. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your having
all
me
right.
on your show.
Thanks, Bill.
You've been listening to a conversation with William J. Bush about his book, Greenback Dollar, The Incredible Rise of the Kingston Trio, released by the Scarecrow Press in 2013. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for more interviews with authors about books on popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.